طفلة تمتطيه قوساق زحف، طفلة تمتطيه قوساق زحف من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Now that the two-state solution is dead, Israeli anthropologist and activist Jeff Halper, co-founder of the Israeli Coalition Against House Demolitions, is working with a group of Palestinians and Israelis to develop a possible framework for what a truly democratic, inclusive, one state could look like. He spoke to a group in Bremen, Germany, where he outlined what this unique group has come up with for this new democratic one state vision. Excerpts from this speech are today's feature presentation. So here is Jeff Halper speaking from Bremen, Germany.
So, guten Tag, or guten evening. It's good to be back in Bremen. I've been here before. I'm in the middle of a three-week speaking tour of Germany. 16 cities in 21 days. So, we're going to do two things tonight, kind of put two presentations into one, inshallah. First, I want to kind of update you on where we are in Israel-Palestine. And especially, I want to relate to the question in England, where are we headed in Israel-Palestine? Because right now we're in a situation where we're kind of floundering without an end game. But one reason why we should really concern ourselves with the Israel-Palestine conflict is because this isn't only a localized conflict between two local people. There's 1,000 conflicts like that in the world. But this is really part of a global conflict that affects the entire international system. That kind of simple solution is what's known as the two-state solution. The idea of a Palestinian state in what we call the occupied territories, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, alongside the State of Israel. This is actually a very pro-Israeli solution to the conflict. Because in this country today, between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, half the population is Palestinian. And there are 5 million refugees that have a right to return. So there will be a Palestinian majority in this country, whether or not the refugees return. So even though the Palestinians are the majority population, they have agreed to make peace with Israel for 22% of their country. In other words, the occupied territory represents only 22% of historic Palestine. Now, Palestinians never get credit for this. They're seen often by the international community as the intransigent ones, the unreasonable ones that don't want peace. Terrorists, of course, is a useful term to throw out all the time. Even though I don't think there has ever been a case in history where a colonized people gave up claim to 78% of their country. So even though this solution is a very pro-Israel solution, the Palestinians accepted it 30 years ago, in 1988, when the PLO in Tunis formally accepted the two-state solution. The two-state solution was also accepted by the Arab League in 2002, almost 20 years ago, in which the Arab League said unanimously that we will normalize relations with Israel if Israel gives up the occupation. The two-state solution is also the solution of the entire international community. The UN, the US, Europe, Germany, all accept the two-state solution as the solution to the conflict. There was only one party that said no, and that was Israel. Successive governments, Labour and Likud, left and right, have said over the years, since 1967, so over the last 50 years, no to the two-state solution. Not only did Israel say no, but it's created what I call a matrix of control over the occupied territory that makes its control permanent. In fact, Israel says there is no occupation because this entire country is the land of Israel and it belongs exclusively to the Jewish people. So, after all these years, Israel has never ever recognized the very existence of a Palestinian people, let alone their national rights. So what Israel has done consciously over the last 50 years is to eliminate the two-state solution by creating what we call facts on the ground. The most important fact are settlements. All these blue areas, all over the West Bank and East Jerusalem, there's about 200 settlements. 800,000 Israelis live today in the Palestinian territory. The territory was fragmented. So there is no coherent territory on which a Palestinian state can be based. The Palestinians today are confined to what we call areas A and B. A is a dark brown, B is the lighter brown, all through the West Bank, and then Gaza, which is basically a cage. A, B and Gaza represent 40% of the occupied territories. In other words, after all these years of negotiations, all the Palestinians have gotten from Israel is 40% of 22% of their country. And that is fragmented into more than 70 little islands spread all through the country. And the Palestinians have also lost Jerusalem. East Jerusalem, that according to the two-state solution idea, was to be the capital of the Palestinian state, was annexed by Israel 50 years ago. So there are today more Israelis living in the eastern part of the city than there are Palestinians. And in fact, the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza are not allowed to come into Jerusalem at all. What Israel's doing now is consolidating the settlements into large cities, urban areas. So these red areas here are what we call, the color isn't very good on the projector, what we call settlement blocks. So that these settlement blocks are becoming large urban areas. Today, in the Israeli parliament, there's a law that's going through the parliament to be passed to create a greater Jerusalem. In other words, four cities in the West Bank, a city called Givat Ze'ev, and then the whole Ma'ale Adumim area that divides the West Bank, east and west, and the Etzion block down south, these areas that make up 15% of the West Bank are now being annexed to a greater Jerusalem. Now, if you still haven't got the message, if you still think the two-state solution is possible, Israel built a wall. Just to put all this literally in concrete, the wall was not built for security reasons. The official name of the wall is the separation barrier. So the wall separates Israelis and Palestinians, and it has two purposes. So one purpose is to incorporate into Israel these settlement blocks. You see, the wall goes, it doesn't follow the border that it would do if it was a security barrier, but it comes way into Palestinian territory in order to incorporate these settlements and Greater Jerusalem into Israel. You can't tell me the wall comes to here for security reasons. The second purpose of the wall is to imprison Palestinians in what Israel calls cantons. So there's a canton in the north. You can see how crazy the lines are because these are settlements in here. So it goes around these settlements like this to create a canton in the north. Then there's a little crazy canton in the center, a canton in the south, and then Gaza. So, what we have then today is one apartheid regime. In other words, Israel eliminated the two-state solution deliberately and systematically. This was a policy. By creating these massive facts on the ground that preclude a Palestinian state. And what we have then, already today, is one state. In other words, in this country, between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, there's only one functioning government. And it's not the Palestinian Authority. There's only one army, obviously. There's only one currency. Whether you're in Gaza or Hebron or Tel Aviv, you're using the Israeli shekel. There's only one electrical system, one water system, one highway system. So by any measure, there already is one country that exists, and it's an apartheid regime. And apartheid is not a slogan. Apartheid means two things. It's when one population separates itself from the others. That's, I mean, it's closer to German than to English. That's apartheid. When one population separates itself from the others, well, you just have to look at the Israeli flag, and you can see that that's the case. And then that population creates a regime of domination over the others. When you have a regime of separation and domination, that's considered apartheid. Today, the Palestinians, again, are half the population of this country, but they're confined to 10% of the land. So, in terms of resolving this conflict, there seems to me to be three options to resolving it. If somebody has a fourth, I'll be happy to hear it. It's almost mathematical, even though anthropologists aren't very good at math. The first option is the two-state solution. It could have worked, and we worked against it. If the Palestinians accept it, I'm not going to say no. So we accepted the two-state solution. Simply for reasons that we've talked about, I would argue that it's gone. It's dead. So Israel, again, deliberately eliminated the two-state solution. And Israel then deliberately created one apartheid regime. So that's option two, because that's exactly what we have today, is exactly what Israel wants. Because we have everything under apartheid. Israel has control of the entire country. It has all its settlements. And the Palestinians do not have citizenship. So it can be a Jewish state. In other words, we have 85% of the land, all the resources under our control, including water, but it's a Jewish state because the Palestinians do not have citizenship. Now, I'm going to assume that all of us do not accept apartheid as a permanent situation in Israel-Palestine. The problem is that our governments do. Governments do not resolve conflicts like we hope they do, but they manage conflicts. So let me just tell you a story. You don't have to, you can do this, translate this, not word from word, but the idea. This is, when I travel, I go to foreign ministries, including the German foreign ministry. And I ask, you know, we talk about this conflict. And they all say, every government in the world will say the two-state solution. Because it's easy. You can manage it. And it can go on and on and on, and it doesn't matter. But I say to them, okay, let's say you, the German government, with your own intelligence and your own information, you come to the conclusion that the two-state solution is gone. What would you do? And the answer is always the same from every government. We can never accept a one-state solution. Because as critical as we are of Israel's occupation, Israel is our friend. And we can't harm Israel. So the only thing we can do, as the German government, let's say, or any government, if the two-state solution is gone, is to simply increase our humanitarian aid to the Palestinians. So what the governments are telling us is we would rather live with apartheid than force Israel to make a just peace with the Palestinians. And that's the problem we're facing. In English, we have a saying that when the people lead, the leaders follow. And this is our problem. Our governments are not going to lead. And so the people have to come up with the solution and pressure our governments to resolve this conflict justly. The problem is that we don't have a solution right now. And you can't be in a political struggle without a solution, without an end game. And for the Palestinians, it's very difficult. You know, the Palestinians have to really lead this. We can't speak for them. And most Palestinians today know that the two-state solution is gone, but they don't believe the one-state solution is possible because of the government's opposition. And so they're really stuck. So we have a small group, a working group, of Palestinians and Israelis. And we're trying to formulate an end game that we can then begin to take forward as a political program. And that, of course, is option three, which basically says this. Okay, Israel, you created one state in this country. You did that, not the Palestinians. You deliberately created one state. We accept that. Fine. But it cannot be an apartheid state. So our job is then to transform the one apartheid regime that Israel has created into a democratic state of equal rights for all its citizens. Which should not be such a shocking idea for Europeans. A democracy. Okay. But here we encounter a fundamental problem. And that is this. In this one country, there will be a Palestinian majority. Well, the Israelis aren't stupid. The Israelis will say, what will prevent the Palestinians from doing to us what we do to them today? Israelis understand very well how you can use a majority in a parliament, in a so-called democracy, and oppress another people. So, because of that fear, they wouldn't accept merely a democratic state. So we have to think about a binational democratic state. So the idea is simple. You have a constitution, which Israel does not have today. Israel is the only country in the world, except Britain, that has the Magna Carta, that does not have a constitution. So you have a constitution, and the constitution would embody the principle of binationalism. In other words, simply to recognize that there are two national groups living in this country, Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Jews, and they each can remain. In other words, they're recognized. And so that removes the fear of Israelis that Parliament can pass a law, you know, to discriminate or throw out Israeli Jews. In other words, Parliament, the Constitution would limit Parliament so it could not pass laws that harm either of the national groups. But this is very difficult for Palestinians to accept. Actually, Palestinians who are citizens of Israel and Palestinians abroad in the diaspora normally don't have a problem with binationalism. I mean, they live by nationalism. But the Palestinians in the occupied territory and in the refugee camps reject binationalism because for them, binationalism means legitimizing Zionism or legitimizing a settler colonialism. And that's very hard for them to do. So today, in our work to try to formulate a one-state solution, we find that the disagreement within the Palestinians over binationalism is more difficult than to try to find an Israeli-Palestinian formula. So we're trying to be really concrete with our ideas to bring them to the Israeli and Palestinian people. And we're playing with different models of what binationalism would be. I'm not going to get into detail tonight, but there's one model that's more binational. It really builds binationalism into the parliament. This would be an easier model for Israelis to accept. And this model that I'll talk about would be easier for Palestinians to accept because it kind of lowers the emphasis on binationalism. So this is actually the model I like the most. And that is this. You find a balance between a national collective identity and creating a common civil society. I think that there are many Israelis and Palestinians, especially in the young generation, and especially more secular people, maybe more middle class people, that don't want to be locked into Israeli-Palestinian identities. I mean, the identities might be important to them, but they want to live in a normal society. They want to live together. And so the emphasis of this would be to create a common Palestinian-Israeli civil society, civil identity. You would have civil marriage, integrated schools. Everybody can live anywhere they want to in the country. And over time, a whole new civil identity would emerge from this society. In other words, I don't want to come to the Israeli public especially, or Palestinians, and say, oh, we have to have a solution, and somehow we have to live together, we don't like each other, but okay, let's see. No, I want to come with a positive, exciting challenge. And the challenge really is, how can we take control of our lives and really build a civil society together that would function well? Now, in this model, if you don't want to be right now in a civil society, or your Palestinian or Israeli identities are still more important to you, okay. In other words, you can be, there's space to be Palestinian and Israeli. And the idea is over time, this civil society will grow to include more people. Let me just give you one example. the Palestinian refugees. You know, the refugees have lived in camps for the last 70 years. They want to come home as Palestinians. They've been fighting for their Palestinian identity all these years. They're not going to come back and jump into a civil society. It's going to take them generation or two or three to begin to reintegrate into society. So they need that space to be just Palestinians in Palestine, which is fine. Settlers and religious Jews aren't going to jump into a civil society either. Okay, keep your space. In other words, you let people have their space, but on condition that you're living within one democratic society with one citizenship and one parliament. All right, now, I want to make a transition now into what I call global Palestine. Let's step back from the local and let's look at how this works out globally. As an activist all these years, there was always a question in the back of my mind. Why didn't Israel accept the two-state solution 30 years ago? Again, it's a pro-Israeli solution. And Israel, if it really wanted peace and security, it could have had peace, security, and 78% of the country 30 years ago. It doesn't make sense that Israel would reject that. So, I began to realize that the Palestinians and the occupied territories mean nothing to Israel. They're not a threat. Israel has international support with the occupation. There's no pressures to give it up. And on the contrary, the occupied territories are a resource for Israel because they constitute a laboratory in which Israel can use Palestinians to test and develop new weapon systems and surveillance systems that they then export internationally. This is part of what I call security politics. When you put weapons and security systems into your international relations. So, there's a few levels here. This is interesting. We always have talked about the Arab-Israeli conflict. And here you have Israel, and the Arab world is against Israel. Today, it's completely changed. In fact, Israel has very close relations with Egypt and the Sisi regime, but as you and with Jordan, it has a peace treaty. But Israel has a love affair today with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. So in the civil war between the Sunnis, the Sunni world, the Arab Sunni world, and the Shiites that are in Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Yemen, Israel has come out publicly on the side of the Sunnis. And you can put into that Israeli partnership Turkey and the Kurds and the Azerbaijanis, the Azeris, and the Sudanese. So, and the North Africans, if you want. So it's a huge alliance that Israel is a part of. But, if I can go one more sentence. But I'm going to say something else that you might not accept. I'm not sure if I accept it. I would argue that Israel is the leader of the Sunni world. You know, Saudi Arabia, which is the largest importer of weapons in the world, can't do anything against Iran, or even in Yemen. It can't do anything without Israeli military support. So Israel, by virtue of its military power, has really become the hegemon of the entire Sunni world. But we can go further than that. We can go further than that. You know, Israel always presents itself as this little country besieged by Muslim Arab terrorism, and it's the victim. So Israel plays all the time on the Jewish part in a very manipulative way, because of course Germany in particular, but all over the world, Jews are synonymous with victims. And if you can be the victim, you're in a very powerful place politically, because you can't hold the victim accountable for anything. The victim's a victim. So if Israel can have massive military power, it's the fourth largest nuclear power in the world.
Train. This happened in South Carolina.
And we are be an occupying power for 50 years. Reported. But have no responsibility, because it's the victim. Wow, you're in a very powerful position. So the idea that Israel does not want to give up the occupied territory in order to develop its weapons and security systems on Palestinians becomes very evident when you look at Israel's place in the world in terms of the military, security, and then politically, because they're connected. And all of a sudden you begin to see that Israel is not this little isolated victim, but in fact it's a tremendously powerful country. It's the sixth largest arms exporter in the world. So just let's look at this map for a minute. It's really interesting. We all know that Israel is very close to the United States. It gets $3.5 billion a year in military aid. But more important, it has access to American military technology. And that's what gives it that technological ability, Israel. But Israel, of course, also has very close relations with Europe. The new European drone, surveillance and attack drone of Europe, called the Watchkeeper, is an Israeli drone. And Israel has close relations, of course, with Germany. On the one hand, you know, you're selling and giving Israel 9 nuclear-capable submarines. Okay? Now, just to show you how generous that is, 3 of them are a gift from the German taxpayer to Israel. So for Christmas, I want to say thank you. Just to tell you, you know how many nuclear-capable submarines Britain has? 2. China has 6. So Israel is going to have 9 nuclear-capable submarines And for what? Not against the Palestinians. Even more, I think, dangerous than that, I'm not going to get into a whole thing tonight, is that Israel and Germany and the United States and China are the world's leading powers in the development of nano weapons. And a nano weapon is much more powerful than a nuclear weapon. And we don't know about this whole industry. So, just in a word, because I'm not going to do the whole presentation. A nano is a billionth of a meter. Your hair, if you take a piece of your hair, it's 100 nanos wide, a hair. A nano weapon is 10 nanos wide. So a nano weapon is, you know, a tenth of the size of a hair. And you can load a nano weapon with poisons or diseases or materials. And we're not there yet. This is going to happen in the next 10 or 15 years. These nano robots can self-replicate, meaning that one can produce a trillion other ones just like it within 2 or 3 days. So, all right, I'm diverting a little bit. Just for a minute, though, because I'm not going to do this whole presentation. Just to show you for a second, this is kind of a micro drone. So, this is the product of the Technion, Israel's Polytechnic. Now, these are very sophisticated surveillance cameras connected to a database. So this is the ultimate surveillance device. But this can be poisons or diseases. Now there's a disease called botulism. Botulism is a disease that has no antidote. Well, if you do a nano, with nanotechnology, you can reduce the botulism, virus, to microscopic sizes. So, this amount of botulism in a nano form can kill 100,000 people. So this cute little drone is actually probably more powerful in many ways than a nuclear weapon. I mean, this amount of botulism put in the water supply of Bremen would wipe out everybody. So these are the kinds of weapons that Israel and Germany and other countries are developing. One reason why I wrote this book about weapons is because we don't know anything about the left. Doesn't know, and the public doesn't know anything about these weapons. I didn't either. I wrote a book about something I know nothing about. But this is all part of the story that we have to know about. Just to give you a peek for other kinds of nano micro weapons, you can weaponize insects, and of course the weapons we talked about. All right, let's go back to the big picture again. So you have high-tech weapons developments between Israel, Europe, the U.S., but look, there's something else interesting. Israel is the number two arms supplier to China after Russia. Whoa, that's interesting, because we always think of Israel as a client country of the United States. We love America. America loves Israel. Well, here we're the number two arms supplier to America's greatest rival, which is China. And look, Israel is the number two or three largest arms supplier to India. So Israel is the number two or three largest arms supplier to two of the largest militaries in the world. Israeli police work with the police in Rio and Sao Paulo to pacify the favelas. Israel has helped Brazil establish what is called, the name is, the Pacification Police Unit. So I could go, and I won't, I have pity on you. I could go country by country and explain exactly the relationship of Israel to the ruling classes. In other words, this is the security politics. This is the deal. That we, Israel, will help you, the powers in every country, to stay in control. Whether it's police help, like Egypt and Brazil, or it's military help, security, whatever, we will help you. And in return, you'll let us keep the occupation. And in this whole thing, again, the Palestinians are really irrelevant, except for being the ones that we test the weapons on.
Well, we have to stop there. But over the next several months, we will continue to follow the efforts of this Palestinian-Israeli working group as they continue to forge a consensus for a way forward in the consideration of a truly democratic, inclusive, one-state solution. You have been listening to Professor Jeff Halper speaking from Bremen, Germany. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.